Welcome back. I'm Hannah Ababa, filling in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Silicon Valley is making waves in immigration reform, not around undocumented immigrants or farm workers, but rather the technology sector. A recent bill heading for the Senate next month could drastically increase the number of high-skilled, foreign-born workers involved in the tech industry. Part of immigration reform, this new bipartisan bill will award permanent residency green cards to any immigrant with an advanced degree in science, technology, engineering, or math. It also greatly increases the number of H-1B visas that go to high-skilled foreign workers from 65,000 to as many as 180,000 visas. The increase of H-1B visas was originally accompanied by protections for U.S. workers, but they ended up mostly removed from the bill thanks to a concerted lobbying effort from major tech companies, many of them right here in Silicon Valley. Provisions requiring tech companies to offer jobs to equally qualified U.S. citizens while banning companies from displacing U.S. workers didn't make it into the latest version of the bill. So now these limitations only apply to the companies most dependent on H-1B visas. That excludes many major U.S. companies. Senators from both the Democrat side and the Republican side are supporting it. Senator Orrin Hatch intervened on behalf of the tech industry, saying these are companies looking to contribute to the American economy in a way that benefits American workers and American-trained foreign workers. And today we'll delve into the question, is that really true? Is it good for America, for the economy, for the California economy? Is it good to increase these H-1B visas? Joining us today for this discussion is Dr. Ronil Hira, who's been studying high-skill immigration for over a decade. He's an associate professor of public policy at the Rochester Institute of Technology and research associate at the Economic Policy Institute. His recent book called Outsourcing America examines the economic and policy implications of the offshoring of high-skill jobs. And last month, he testified in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee concerning this new immigration bill. Welcome, Ronil.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Also with us is Gordon Hansen. He's a professor of economics at UC San Diego and holds the Pacific Economic Cooperation Chair in International Economic Relations. He's also a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and co-editor of the Review on Economics and Statistics. He joins us from San Diego. Hi, Gordon.
Good morning.
Thank you both for joining us. Today, we'll just delve into this issue of the H-1B visas. Ronil, let me start with you. In your testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee, you started by saying, I have reached the conclusion that the H-1B program does more harm than good. Why don't we get into that? Why did you reach that conclusion? How?
Well, first off, it does some good. It is an important pathway for some very highly skilled workers to come in and stay here permanently. Those are workers who don't have family members, don't have other channels to come to the U.S. and stay here permanently. So it does some good, and that's really important to keep in mind. But what's happened is that the criteria that's used to determine whether an employer gets an H-1B worker or not is so loose that it's really gotten out of control. And the primary use has now been really for cheaper indentured workers. And probably the most visible use is that all of the top 10 H-1B employers who got more than half of all the H-1Bs last year, 40,000 or more, are all using it for offshore outsourcing. So these aren't your Silicon Valley stalwarts like Facebook and Google and Microsoft. These are companies like Cognizant and Tata and Infosys and Accenture that are really just offshoring the work and bringing in cheaper workers. So that's why I think it's doing more harm than good.
A lot of them are based in Bangalore, right?
Yes. Well, Cognizant's based in Teaneck, New Jersey, so it's really a business model. But these are the big Indian offshore outsourcing firms. That's correct.
Interesting. And so you've been concerned about what you say are loopholes in the H-1B program that have basically made it easier to bring in cheaper foreign workers who then not complement U.S. workers but substitute them, and that originally the idea of the H-1B visa was to complement U.S. workers, not to substitute them, but that's what's happening.
Yeah, that's correct. So, I mean, the most egregious examples are where, you know, American workers are actually training their foreign replacements, and that's been going on in lots of places, and I'm sure in Silicon Valley, too. Here in Rochester, one of the major employers outsourced its product engineering to one of the major offshore outsourcing firms, HCL. And so I personally know engineers who are actually training their foreign replacements, and that's going on all over the country. This is quite a common example. But there's also subtle ways in which firms are really bringing in cheaper H-1B workers. You know, they're laying off their older workers. IBM's known to be doing this. And they're bringing in, at the same time, hiring H-1B and L-1 workers. So there's both the sort of very explicit, obvious examples where, you know, American workers are training the foreign replacements. And then there's the more subtle impacts where you know, you've sort of these regular layoffs of older workers, and then they're hiring in the lower cost contract workers through these firms.
So then why do you think this part of the bill has gained such support and looks like it might go through?
Well, I think what's happened is that the tech industry got lucky with the politics here. If this was a high skill immigration bill standalone, you would have had a much more balanced bill between what employers wanted and what safeguards you had for American workers, as well as the foreign workers who often come in and can be exploited. But because of the nature of the politics of comprehensive immigration reform, the Democrats really want a path to citizenship. And so the tech industry was able to leverage its political clout, as well as flood Washington with millions of dollars to fund studies and to fund public relations, to lobby, campaign contributions, everything else. And so they really got into a particularly lucky position here. And you really don't have that counterbalance where there's an organized group that's representing American high-tech workers. You know, you've got the labor unions, but their real interest is more on the path to citizenship for the undocumented. You've got IEEE, which is a small organization in terms of its lobbying presence in Washington. So you really had a sort of David versus Goliath, and in this case, the Goliath won. And I think, unfortunately, for both American workers as well as the future of the American economy.
Let me go to Gordon Hanson, and if we can talk about how this increase in H-1B visas will affect our economy, the U.S. economy here, the California economy. I'm sitting in San Francisco, 20 minutes away from these big tech companies in Silicon Valley. What will this do? What will the effect be economically?
So we need to keep in mind what we want the objective of immigration policy to be, and that's to raise living standards in the United States. So what has economic research over the last three or four decades told us about how you do that? Well, the key to raising living standards is innovation and productivity growth. And key to productivity growth is the supply of workers you have in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. So complaints about the H-1B program often fall into the lump of labor fallacy, this idea that we only have a certain number of jobs to go around, and if we give more jobs to foreigners, there are less jobs available to native workers. If you look at the tech sector, however, it's this amazingly dynamic place. The more supply we have of workers in STEM jobs, in science, technology, engineering, and math, the larger that sector is going to be in the United States and the greater its capacity for innovation. So the key for us is expanding our innovative capacity, and I think the immigration bill makes positive steps in that direction.
Ranil, would you like to comment on that?
Well, I think that's a pretty simple way of thinking about it. What he's basically saying is that all we have to do is just increase numbers. The problem is that it does have effects, I think more complex effects than that, on the labor supply and inducing students to going into these fields. And, of course, it does negatively impact those American workers who are going to be substituted or will then have to compete for lower wages.
I'd like to invite the audience to join this conversation. If you work in tech, if you are in Silicon Valley, you're listening to us right now, you came on an H-1B visa. What's been your experience? If you know someone who has, what's been their experience? And if you're a native worker, an American tech worker, how do you feel about those who come on H-1B visas, and how do you feel about this increase in H-1B visas that is being proposed right now? Give us a call at 866-798-TALK if you'd like to share your comments, or if you have a question for one of our guests, 866-798-8255, or you can shoot us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. That's feedback@yourcallradio.org. So we have an issue here where there's kind of two sides, kind of the pro increasing the H-1B program and the anti, and there's lots of people kind of in the middle trying to figure out what's going on. But how about some numbers? Like Ranil, if you can give me like, how do we know how many H-1B visa workers end up kind of staying? Because I think part of your argument, you're saying that, you know, these people don't come and stay the 3 years and then leave. They're staying and their contracts are being renewed for another 3 years and another 3 years, and then they stay and take the place of the American tech worker. So what are, is that what you're saying, first of all?
I think it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Uh-huh.
So these are, the H-1B is a guest worker program. And that, I think, has different impacts than green cards, which is a legal permanent residence. And I think they'll have two different kinds of impacts on the labor force, but more importantly, in the ways in which and how we decide to bring in skilled workers. So it's one thing to talk about the supply, and if, let's say, we used a system like in Canada, where you use more of a merit point system, where you're just increasing the supply of workers. In this case, what we do is we have employers making these selections and deciding who's going to come, how many, and so on. And what they're doing is they're really intervening in the labor market. And so the question becomes around a guest worker. What you want to do is talk about, you know, what should the wage floors be, what kind of working conditions, and when should when should policymakers allow companies to come in and intervene in the labor market to bring in additional workers? To me, what you want to do is set those thresholds high enough so that you're not undercutting American workers and American students, and you're also not placing foreign workers in a negative position. When you're talking about green cards and legal permanent residence, I think that the situation is a little bit different because those workers are mobile and can bargain for themselves. And if they get laid off, they're not out of status and don't have to leave permanently. So what's happened with the H-1B program is it's been taken over by actually firms that are not trying to bring in the best and brightest and are not trying to keep them here permanently, but instead who are bringing in lower-cost workers who are really have ordinary skills that are already abundantly available here in the U.S.
Gordon Hanson, why don't you kind of jump in there? This idea of bringing in people for, you know, indefinitely, you know, to be a part of the American fabric is, you know, as old as America itself, many people would say. I think Marco Rubio, I don't quote him frequently, but I think he said something like, you know, we do want the best and brightest, you know, all the PhD holders and to come to America. That's what this country is about. So, I mean, how can we safeguard our American, kind of our native workforce, though?
Think about what the U.S. economy is built on. It's built on the idea of attracting individuals who are willing to give it their all and who earn their rewards in the marketplace. And those rewards are going to be wonderful if you succeed, and they're not going to be so wonderful if you fail. When it comes to immigration, you know, what we've succeeded in doing is attracting people who've enriched American society and enriched our economic capabilities in myriad ways. And in the tech world, there are just abundant examples of how this has played itself out. So look at, you can start at the top and work your way down. Look at Nobel Prize winners who reside in the U.S. in science, in chemistry and medicine and physics in the last 30 years. Nearly 30% of those are individuals who were born outside the United States. Look at members of the National Academy of Sciences. So these are the elite academics in their respective fields. If you look at engineering, you've got nearly 40% of National Academy of Science members are foreign-born. Look at the tenured faculty members of the top engineering and computer science and mathematics departments. So look at Stanford and Berkeley and MIT. What fraction of those of tenured faculty members in those departments were born outside the United States? It's somewhere between 30 and 45%, depending on the department that you're looking at. So what we've done is to create the society where we invite talent to come from different parts of the world. Many of those individuals enter on H-1B visas. Coming out of school or moving from a foreign job or foreign university, their point of entry is an H-1B visa. Some of those individuals aren't going to succeed, and they're going to go home. Many others will succeed and will end up transitioning to a green card after some period of time. But you want to view that H-1B visa not as an end in itself. It's a vehicle to permanence, and it's not going to lead to permanence for everyone, but it is leading to permanence for individuals who are succeeding in the U.S. economy.
Okay. Let me just remind our listeners of our phone number. We do have full lines now, but we'll empty some up for you. The number is 866-798-8255, or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you're on an H-1B visa here in California, you're listening to us, call us and share your experience with us. And what do you think of all this criticism of H-1B visas and the increase of the visa? Let's go to our callers. Let's start off with Pam in Oakland. Hi, Pam. Welcome to your call.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, my question is really, why isn't there more protection for American tech workers? I'm 58 years old. I worked in tech in marketing for all the top firms in Silicon Valley for 20 or 30 years. All of my colleagues are no longer at tech firms. Anyone over 50, they just started to let you go. I worked at Wells Fargo as a project manager. You walk there. They make a lot of noise about themselves being a great San Francisco civic employer. There are entire floors of Indian tech workers. There are maps of India with all the different languages spoken on this floor. And all the project management jobs that used to go to local workers are now being taken on by Indian workers. I love India. I love Indians. But I don't like this employment policy. And I see that my friends and I are just out of work, and there are no jobs.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like to hear some responses.
Okay, thanks, Pam. Gordon, have you heard this a lot from kind of older tech workers, American older tech workers, and what kind of responses do you give?
Well, if you look at what's happened in the U.S. labor market in the last decade, it's been a tough period, in particular since 2007. We had an unprecedented economic downturn and an unprecedentedly slow recovery out of that downturn. So you're going to find many individuals who've had a tough time, and older workers in particular have had a tough time with that transition. You look across the market, though, and I don't want to discount the difficult experiences that individuals like Pam or her friends may have had. But if you look at what the numbers say, so I just in trying to understand how is the market for tech labor evolving in the U.S. What I did was to go look at unemployment rates for workers in STEM occupations, so in science, technology, engineering, and math, who are 25 to 54. And you certainly saw a sharp increase in unemployment rates for those workers from 2007 to 2009. Then they stabilized, and since 2010, they've been falling really sharply. So they went from a little over 4%, and now they're just a little over 2%. So you have evidence, despite the fact that you're going to find lots of corners of the U.S. economy where people are still having a tough time. What's happening overall in the STEM labor market is actually things are getting pretty tight, and that demand for labor is only going to get tighter absent the opportunity to bring in additional supplies of workers, whether that's graduates from U.S. universities or individuals from abroad.
Let's go to another caller, and this is Maureen in San Francisco. Hi, Maureen.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead. Welcome to your call.
I find it really kind of insulting that American workers are being told that they're not smart enough to fill these jobs. I invested, and the government invested in me, to give me a nursing degree, only to have it just completely flooded where applications are looked at on a lottery basis. The graduates at USF were told in 2008 that the only way they could get a job was to spend 2 years in Iraq. You look on Craigslist still, it says no new grads need apply. We have absolutely a flood of qualified people that we've paid for. In my case, the government spent about $30,000 in Pell Grant money. We have supported public universities to supply these demands for labor. And then we say, oh, we don't have enough people. It's not true. We need to protect our own workers. And I'll tell you, when the foreign workers come in, I experienced this many times at clinical, they are very protective of one another. And you will have them playing all kinds of games to bring in their relatives, where they're speaking in their own language and plotting and all kinds of politics within the workplace. They're very, very protective of one another. I think we need to protect ourselves and employ our graduates that we've invested so much money in our tax dollars.
Okay. Thank you, Maureen, for the call. Ranil, here, are these things that you're hearing now from the callers, did you find evidence of more of those kinds of feelings in your research?
Well, I think there's definitely some bitter feelings about how these programs are being run. I can't talk so much about the nursing side, but certainly a lot of American tech workers feel quite disaffected, feel like that their government is actually working against them and against their livelihoods, and are frankly pretty outraged by the fact that this goes on, where they actually are training their replacements, where they're losing their jobs, where they're being undercut in terms of salaries. I guess, and it's kind of shocking that the politically the tech industry has just been so strong as to more or less get its way. So I certainly sympathize with American workers who feel like they're being undercut, because I think they're basically right about what the policy's been. This is really about guest worker programs, and it's not about Nobel Prize winners. That's highly misleading. It's really about the typical H-1B worker coming in, working in the back office of a bank like a Wells Fargo, but working as a contractor with no hopes of ever getting a green card because their employer will never sponsor them. They're really being used for less expensive labor, and it's undercutting and undermining American workers.
Gordon, you want to take that on? We have a minute before break.
Sure. So there's this, we hear these repeated accusations that these foreign workers are coming in and taking jobs at cut-rate wages. I'm sure you can find abundant anecdotes of abuses of one kind or another. But what do the data say on average in terms of happening in the tech labor market? You don't see evidence in it. So what I did was to go out and look at the most comprehensive labor market data you can find, and that comes from the American Community Survey. I looked at tech workers, either with BA degrees or with master's degrees. I look at individuals who are foreign-born, U.S.-born, of the same age, same educational backgrounds in these tech occupations. And what you find is just no systematic difference between the earnings of these workers. Now, you can't identify in these data who has an H-1B and who doesn't, but you can look at workers who arrived after age 18 or after age 20 or 22, so workers who certainly look like they came in on H-1B. They're just not wage differences there. So I don't think in the broad swath of data, you see evidence in support of that undercutting.
And we can pick that up right after the break. That's Gordon Hansen. With me also is Ranil Hira. We will be right back to your call.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. We invite you to get involved in today's conversation. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to the program, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email, question, or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Welcome back. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Your Call. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. And we also want to hear from you. Call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also post your comments or questions on our website at yourcallradio.org for everyone to see and comment back on. Today, we're talking about H-1B visas. And with me is Ronil Hira, who's been studying high-skill immigration for over a decade. His recent book, Outsourcing America, examines the implications of the offshoring of high-skilled jobs. Gordon Hansen is professor of economics at UC San Diego. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and co-editor of the Review of Economics and Statistics. We have full lines. Let's go straight to the lines, try to get some of the callers in. So let's go to Michelle in Santa Cruz. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to Your Call. Hi, Michelle. Go ahead. Okay. Call us back, Michelle, please. So I want to get into, you know, when we think of H-1B workers or high-skilled tech workers, we think of technology and IT. But immigrants working in medical fields and science fields, as was referred to earlier by Maureen in San Francisco, she's a nurse, it looks like immigrants in those fields often are paid more than American workers in the same fields, while the IT visa workers end up paid less. So how does that work, Ronil, and why is that? Why are immigrants working in medical and science fields getting paid more than the Americans in the same field?
Well, I'm not an expert on the medical and the sciences. What I would say on the IT side, what you find is really not quite a bimodal distribution, but something like a bimodal distribution, where you have some very high-wage, highly skilled people who are paid a lot of money on H-1Bs, and then you have a very large number who are paid fairly low wages. And, you know, just to give you a sense, you know, computer occupations, the median wage for H-1Bs, for new H-1Bs, the most recent data we have was $64,000, which is not a small wage, but it is relative to what IT workers in the U.S. should be getting, which is about $81,000 or more in a place like Silicon Valley. Plus, Professor Hansen obviously hasn't talked to anybody in the industry. If he would, he would realize that Cognizant didn't bring in 9,000 H-1Bs last year because they were more expensive or they had some specialized skills. Cognizant, which got the most H-1Bs last year, is bringing in workers because they're less expensive. And Wall Street knows this. If you read the earnings call transcripts, if you follow this sector at all, the firms that are bringing in the most H-1Bs are highly profitable because they're able to bring in high-skilled workers at much lower wages. In the San Francisco Chronicle today, I believe, in a news article, Neeraj Gupta, who used to be an executive with one of these firms with Putney, says this and said this in his testimony sitting next to me before the Senate just a couple of weeks ago, said when he was in that sector as an executive, everybody knew that they could underprice American firms that hired American workers by 20 to 25% because H-1B workers were 20 to 25% less expensive for the equivalent kind of occupations. So it seems like everybody knows this, but for whatever reason, there seems to be some confusion in the data. I'm not sure why that is.
Gordon Hansen, what do you say to that?
Well, I think what we get from folks like Ron Hira is just a continuous stream of anecdotes about what's happening in the industry. And you can, and you know, in a complicated labor market like IT, you can find a broad range of experiences. But what the central tendencies in the data show, we can pick up from the standard measures of labor market outcomes. And what those show is tech workers, foreign and native-born, are earning substantially similar wages. Now, the statistics that get cited by Ron Hira and others are not actually based on wages that that individuals get paid. They're based on these applications that firms make to in order to get the H-1B visa in the first place. What happens when these workers actually get employed is then you have bonus systems, and then you have overtime, and then you have all this other stuff, and then you have people who get promoted, and you have new projects that come along. So a much better indication about what's actually happening in the labor market is to look at the wages they get paid rather than kind of the obscure numbers that get cited in the application process. So what I've tried to do in my research is look at the data that that labor economists use for understanding labor market outcomes. And what those data show is just no wage difference between foreign and native-born IT workers on average.
Ronil, how do you feel about not the H-1B visa side, but the green card side of this bill that green cards will be granted to those who have advanced degrees in the STEM fields? Does that one make you feel okay?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that are in the bill on the green card side. I think on the positive side, there's a merit point system, which I think will increase and shift us more towards skilled workers. I think that's a real positive. I think the way that they wrote the STEM green card part of the bill, I think, is problematic because unlike what passed the House last year, what they've done is they've basically given instant green cards to anybody who graduates with a STEM master, so a master's degree in science or engineering. And what I think this does is it creates a conflict of interest for universities, because essentially what they'll be set up doing is be the gatekeepers for green cards. And getting a master's degree is not all that expensive and won't take all that long. And what I think it'll do is it induce universities to start basically selling green cards as master's degrees. And I think that's a real problem. I think there needs to be labor certification and some other controls like we saw on the House bill that was just introduced actually a couple of weeks ago by ISSA and Goodlatte, where you have some controls over the numbers as well as quality control. Otherwise, you'll end up with these universities that'll see this as a very lucrative market. And so there's some problems in there. I mean, in principle, I think we want to move towards a skilled, more skilled immigration and more permanent immigration as opposed to guest workers. But I think there's some problems in the way that this bill is written, at least on the STEM green card side of things.
Let's go back to our callers. Let's go to Kevin in Felton. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to Your Call.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. There's a couple of things I'd like to point out, one of which is that if you're working in Silicon Valley right now, you can't put down your keyboard and call in to this program because you'll get fired. And the main point I'd like to make has to do with the structure of the high-tech industry and the way that technology is constantly changing and how that disadvantages American workers. For instance, if you're a college student, say, in India, which has a very powerful educational system for high-tech, and you want to emigrate to the United States, you'll research, or your professors will research, what is the up-and-coming tool, software tool, that would best get you a job. So you specify your education onto that technology. Now, if you're an American worker, you're supporting an existing technology that the company you work for may be planning to phase out. And so what happens? Well, they get an H-1 visa agreement. They toss the American worker who supported the system that made them rich, and then they supplant him with somebody who's getting paid half as much and bring him in from a foreign country. I found this profoundly insulting, and I'm amazed that people are putting up with it. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Let's go straight to Jenny in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Call.
Hi there. I'm calling because I was an employee of Wells Fargo working in a tech department in which the manager was Indian.
I'm sorry, Jenny, can you speak up a little bit?
Yes.
Thank you.
Basically, the manager was Indian, and I was his assistant. and project manager. And we worked with about 19 Indians who were recently came to America. And they were no more skilled than other people in those roles. It was my job to onboard and offboard them as contractors. So I saw their pay and I saw their qualifications. And they were no more qualified than other people I knew personally and who worked for Wells Fargo. They got paid the same rate. And I'd like to say that the most important thing to me was their disrespect for women in the workplace.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Jenny and Kevin in Felton as well. So I want to invite you again, 800-866-798-8255. We still have a couple of lines open. Lots of emotion coming out, Gordon Hansen, and the Indians has come up many, many times. Do you think at all is a cultural kind of conflict happening as well? And
certainly. But that's the nature of the immigration process. Immigration is unsettling. Yeah, you bring people with a different way of life who come out of different cultural traditions, different views of marriage, of work, of family, and it complicates things. And it's complicated things in our country since its inception. But the great thing about America is the way in which we take the best of what different cultures have to offer us. And these concerns about the foreign groups coming in have existed, again, since the inception of our republic. You go back to one of the first opponents of immigration, who, funnily enough, was Benjamin Franklin. What was Benjamin Franklin's big concern? It was the Germans. He was worried that the Germans were going to Germanize Americans before we had a chance to Anglicize them. Today, no one is really talking about the problems of cultural differences between people of German descent and people of other descent. So these are things that are conflictual at the start. They work themselves out over time. And it's the brilliance of America that we have a set of institutions which is resilient enough to take the best of what people have to offer from whatever part of the world they're coming from.
And Ranil Hira, what's wrong with that?
I agree wholeheartedly with everything. My parents actually immigrated from India, so I understand. What's your feeling then? I agree with all that, but let's be careful to separate out what we're talking about, which is guest workers from immigrants. We're a nation of immigrants, not a nation of guest workers. And what we're talking about is guest worker policy here, right? At where the worker doesn't hold the work permit, but the employer holds it, and then that worker is really indentured, is beholden to that employer, and where Congress sets the wage floors. So we need to set those wage floors in a way that doesn't undercut the American workforce. If employers want more guest workers, shouldn't there be regulations around how we regulate those guest workers? That's really what the conversation is about.
So there's no cultural aspect to it, do you think?
Well, there's always going to be cultural aspects when we're talking about immigration. The question here is, do we want more guest workers? And if so, under what wages and working conditions do you bring in those guest workers?
All right, let's go to Andy in Redwood City. Hi, Andy. Welcome to your call.
Hi, good morning, Holly.
Hi.
And thank you, the professor from Rochester, for sticking up for American workers and being a real truth teller. Mr. Hansen, let's throw out some economics things, since you're an economic professor. I find your logic really kind of ridiculous. There's supply and demand. There's a limited number of jobs out there. We're going to up H-1B from 60K to 110K. I know a friend of mine working at Target. I know another one working at Trader Joe's. These are engineers. I know another one that has an advanced degree from Carnegie Mellon. There are only a limited number of seats. When you take those seats away, you basically murder and destroy the American worker. And when you have more supply, you lower the prices. And that's why wages are low for everybody across the board, no matter H-1B or American worker. It lowers the wages across the board. So that's the bottom line to this. It's supply and demand, and they just want more supply, and it's going to lower the wages of everybody and bring down everybody to the bottom. I mean, it's the race to the bottom, and that's what H-1B is doing. And it's just destroying the American worker. It's destroying our lives, sir. It is ruining us. It is just ruining us. Thank you, the professor from Rochester again for sticking up for the truth. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Professor Hansen.
Sure. And, you know, again, I don't want to discount the experiences of individuals like Andy and you know, the tough times they or their friends may have had in the labor market. And, you know, as an economist, what's my job? You know, it's not to make sense of individual experiences. It's to try and understand how markets develop and evolve over time. And Andy's correct to say if the only thing that would have been going on was an increase in the supply of tech workers, that would have pushed down wages. But it's not the only thing that's been going on. There's also been this very robust increase in demand for tech workers coming from the remarkable advance of the tech industry in the United States. So you go back to 1980, which is, you know, just before kind of everything got started, before MS-DOS came online and the first Mac and the 8386 processor from Intel and so forth. Since that time, the supply of IT workers with college degrees or more relative to non-IT workers with college degrees or more has increased by about 30%. So we've seen a big increase in supply of those guys over time. What's happened to the wages of those tech workers relative to the wages of other folks? Well, the wage premium for tech workers went from about 15% in the 1970s to about 25% today. And that wage premium, so that's the extra income that you get if you're a tech worker relative to a non-tech worker with the same education level, the same age, and everything else we can tell about you from the best available data sources, has just been resilient over time. Despite this massive increase in the supply of tech workers, what's happened is that increase in the demand coming from the growth of the industry has kept wages in the sector strong. And that's why we're such a magnet for tech talent from all over the world.
Let's go to another caller, John in San Francisco. Hey, John, welcome to your call.
Hi.
Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on.
Yeah, this is Ed, actually. I'd like to agree with the last caller 100%. H1 and H2 visa have been disastrous to American labor, American workers, high-tech American workers. I had many friends. I lived in Silicon Valley for about 7-8 years, late 80s, early 90s. A lot of my neighbors lost their homes and their work by being laid off. They were making $200,000 or $300,000 salary, and they ended up replaced by an East Indian who were making $20,000. People like your guest who are defending H-1, H-2 visa should be ashamed of themselves, as well as people like the guy from Microsoft, Bill Gates, other high-tech people. They betrayed this country a great deal, and they really, really, it is a continuation of the destruction of the American, as we know, the American workers, the American labor, the American style of life. And, you know, those poor Indians, they also get exploited as well, and they get paid fraction what the salary should have been. I lived through it for many years, and really, again, shame on that other guest you have.
Thank you.
Just puppet for the industry.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call, Aid. Let's go through these calls. Many of you are on the line. Let's go to Don in Palo Alto. Hey, Don, you're on.
Oh, hi. I have three graduate degrees, computer science, math, operations research. I worked in Silicon Valley for the last 25 years in a variety of companies, HP, General Electric, NASA, Ames, etc. I haven't seen H-1 people taking a job away from me. What I've seen is that 1 out of 10 startups are headed by a person from India. I've seen Silicon Valley being at the forefront of the world in technology, in part because of the influx of highly skilled people. I think it's a net plus. I have seen a few people falling by the wayside, and in all cases, it's because they didn't keep up their skills. So if they learned something in the 80s and they haven't gone back to school and kept current with the technology, yes, those people don't do well, but that's their own doing. But if they keep up their skills, I haven't seen anyone lose a job to an H-1 person.
First different perspective this hour. Let's go to Michelle is back with us. Hey, Michelle, you're on. Michelle? Hello? Okay. All right. So, you know, it seems like most of our callers that have called in have this perspective against H-1B visas, and, you know, a couple haven't. But, you know, Gordon, how do you respond to the overall kind of just overall influx of negative feeling towards this H-1B deal? And will it pass? Will it go through?
No disrespect intended to the callers who've offered their viewpoints on this program. I think, you know, part of what we're seeing is just unease about the state of the American labor market. And so look beyond tech, kind of what's happened over the last couple of decades. The labor market's been brilliant for people who are highly skilled, and in particular who have skills that are in demand by tech or finance or management consulting and so forth. For people who are who lack those skills, the environment's been much rougher. And as the last caller just mentioned, for people who fall a little bit behind, when there's moments of transition like we've seen since the Great Recession in 2007, the market outcomes can be pretty rough. But you know, what has the tech sector done for the United States? It has been the primary source of innovation and productivity growth for the U.S. economy. And what's helped make that sector vibrant? Well, attracting talent from all over the world. Some of those people have gone on to become Nobel quality. Others are just stalwart programmers. The majority of them would be stalwart programmers in tech firms in Silicon Valley and Seattle and other places. There's, you know, in a complicated world like ours, there's going to be a whole range of stories that paint that broader picture. But overall, the vibrancy is undeniable, and that vibrancy has been central to the economic success the U.S. economy has had recently and will have going forward.
Do you see Americans kind of doing the opposite and going overseas for opportunity? How would a migration of Americans to other countries kind of work? Do you see that even happening?
Oh, absolutely. So where are the big market opportunities now? They're in emerging economies. So, you know, you want to look for new firms to invest in. You want to look for new lines of business. It's happening in Sao Paulo. It's happening in Luanda in Angola. It's happening all over China. And we have American workers who are seizing those opportunities. Think just about the economic history of the United States. What allowed us to advance as a country in the 18th and early 19th century? And let's leave the kind of the immigration part out of it. It was this tremendous mobility of people moving from agriculture, moving from small towns, moving to cities. Cities are where it happens. And so that desire of individuals to be in Silicon Valley, that's people moving from the backwater to where the action is at. And that's been a central feature of progress in human history going back 6,000 years. And today, where we have national borders, that to make that progress possible, you have to allow immigration to happen.
Ronil here, I have a comment from one of our listeners for you. I'm going to give it to you. She says, this is Michelle, and she says she's a green card holder in her 50s. She says, education in America has not kept pace with increasing improvements in tech, and we need more money in public education to keep up with high-skill immigrants overseas. So I'm wondering what you kind of say to that general idea that we here are lacking in the STEM fields in terms of education. And so, of course, these, you know, people from abroad who study, you know, who study these STEM fields throughout their lives are going to come in and kind of take over these jobs.
Well, I think what you'd
like
see...
Like it's an education issue for her.
I mean, if there's a skills mismatch, as it's claimed often by companies, by industry executives, and even some others, but without any real evidence of any kind of skills gap, what you'd see is you'd see these companies and you'd see the government start to actually invest in STEM skills, and they're really not. I mean, most of the proposals have been really cosmetic. You know, for example, H-1B fees, there's about $1,000 or so that goes in supposedly to STEM education. I mean, that doesn't even buy a college credit here at my institution where we produce a lot of computer scientists and engineers. I'm at an engineering school. So I think the note is right, is that we should be investing in American workers, and that would happen. But instead, what's happened is the tech industry, and the tech industries have complained about this for many decades now, has chosen instead that the easier and cheaper route is to keep importing guest workers. And that basically displaces or prevents them or makes it so that they don't have to actually invest in American workers. Their incumbent American workers become more disposable because they can get a ready supply of younger, fresher graduates instead of retraining folks. And you see this Microsoft complaining about shortages of workers at the same time that they're laying off 5,000 workers. This is back in 2009. Boeing is laying off 1,500 IT workers. HP in Silicon Valley has laid off tens of thousands of workers. Same with IBM and EDS. What happened to those workers and what happened to American policymakers paying attention to those workers, figuring out how do you get them back into the workplace?
So if you could rewrite this legislation, what changes would you make?
Well, I would do a couple of pretty simple things. One, raise the wage floors significantly. If these are really the best and brightest, as Professor Hansen and the industry executives say, then they should at least be paid average American wages. So you raise the wage floor to the average instead of the 20% discount that they're going to get. And the second is give American workers a first and legitimate shot at these jobs. If there really is this shortage, then the companies ought to show that they've actually looked for American workers and tried to hire them. And when they can't, they can go and get a guest worker to come in. So you have those two things as well as a non-displacement. I think you would solve a lot of the problems and issues that people have. If these are really, truly specialized folks, then you would expect the companies to at least look for American workers first and to pay at least average wages.
Professor Gordon, do you have any things about, any qualms about the bill that you'd like to see change?
There are many imperfections in the bill. The overall thrust of trying to increase the supply of high-skilled labor in the United States, I think, is the right one. But I would disagree with Professor Hira. I don't think we need more regulation. I think we need less. What I would like to see, and, you know, here I'm going to sound like a wonky economist.
For 30 seconds.
I think we should auction the visas. I think the visas should go to their most highly valued use. And that way you're going to solve the problem of them going to the best and the brightest, because who's going to be willing to pay the most for visas? It's going to be the companies that are in most need of them. That would solve a lot of the problems.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Dr. Ron Hira, Associate Professor at Rochester Institute of Technology, and Professor Gordon Hansen, Professor of Economics at UC San Diego. Thank you for joining us. Thank you all for your calls and emails. Sorry if we couldn't get to you. We'll put a link to web resources at our new website, yourcallradio.org. I'm Hanat Baba, and here's what's coming up on tomorrow's Your Call. What are the history and effects of gentrification? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the changing urban landscape of San Francisco and the Bay Area. How have social movements organized in response to rising housing costs? Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Is gentrification inevitable? Can a city grow without pushing out its poorer residents? If even the middle class is squeezed, where does that leave the most in need? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. We'll be right back.